Hey, Network, it's Adam. This is a rebroadcast of an episode we did with Richard McSpadden. He led the Air Safety Institute for the AOPA and was involved in a fatal accident recently. Rich was a great guest and a friend of TPN. He did so much for not only general but professional aviation. His military background is exemplary, and I felt like we needed to get his voice back out on the airwaves. He was just an awesome human being and somebody I really enjoyed speaking with. A man I wish I could have met in person and flown with. It was truly a loss to all of the world of aviation. Our hearts at TPN go out to his family. At 63 years old, he had so much more to give us, and we hope we can keep learning from what he has contributed over his lifetime by reading what he's written at AOPA and what he's spoken to so many pilots out there. Please enjoy this podcast with Rich McSpadden. Check him out at AOPA.org. Look him up. He was truly a mentor to us all. And as the fighter pilots say, a nickel on the grass. Smooth and calm tailwinds, Rich.
We think a lot about how come we can't get more professional pilots interested in GA? It seems like that would be a logical connection, but oftentimes they just kind of lose touch with it. And when you talk to them, a lot of times they've kind of forgotten and they think, it's kind of hard, it's kind of confusing, and not really. Go flip the mags on, crank, and go flying, you know?
Hey, everybody, it's Adam Juhant back at you again, the co-host of the Pilot Network podcast. And today we're going in a different direction than we normally do. We're always talking about professional aviation and how we can get into the industry details a little bit more precisely. But this one comes at it from a totally different angle. And I'm really excited to welcome our guest, Richard McSpadden. He's the executive director of AOPA Air Safety Institute. Richard is a commercial pilot and CFI with over 4,500 hours and 30 years of flying a variety of civilian and military aircraft. He has extensive experience in aviation safety, including ground, flight, special event operations, you name it, Richard has done it. And prior to joining ASI, Richard had a successful career at Hewlett-Packard, leading large geographically dispersed operations, providing business-critical information technology services all over the globe. Prior to HP, Richard closed his 20-year Air Force career, so just like me, Air Force dude, as the commander and flight leader of the U.S. Air Force Thunderbirds flight demo team. And you guys know what they do. Just unlike me, he actually had a very highly visible and cool job and not necessarily just burning left-hand orbit turns in the sky over wherever they decide that I need to be doing that. So, Richard, I want to thank you for joining us on the Pilot Network podcast, and welcome to a discussion on all things AOPA and all the good stuff that we're going to chat about today.
Yeah, Adam, thanks so much, and thanks for what you guys do in the Pilot Network. It's just great that you've sort of pieced together this community where everybody can come together and just talk aviation and learn a little bit and explore these doors you've never really opened, and really cool stuff. So love what you're doing. Happy to be here.
Thank you. Thanks for saying that. We always appreciate a good flattery. It goes very, very far. So the first thing, let's jump right into your background and where you all started from. And I think the easiest way to do it with pilots, it's kind of the standard question on the Pilot Network podcast, is where did your first interest in aviation start off?
Yeah, it came really from my dad. When my dad turned, it was roughly in his 40s, early 40s, my mom gave him a present of a flight lesson. And he took that. I was about high school, college at the time. And he immediately took to it. He just loved it, as my mom knew he would. And I watched him go through that and saw all the planning at the kitchen table and all that. And I thought, man, that looks like a lot of fun. And he really encouraged me through the years, kind of nudged me to look at flying. He thought I would enjoy it, thought I would be good at it. And I'm really thankful that he did. That's kind of where it came a little bit late for me in life, but that's kind of where it came from.
That is a little bit later than most people we talk about. I one of my good friends in college, like he was the same way. He entered ROTC with me, and his whole goal was, I think he wanted to be a lawyer in the Air Force. You know, he had a scholarship in for like English or something because he did really well in school, and he decided that he thought this flying thing would be super cool. So 18 plus years later, he's still flying fighters on active duty. So I think maybe there's something to it for those of you who are trying to go that route. Maybe delay that passion. I got to do this. You won't put as much pressure on yourself, and you can actually grow into it a little bit better. And next thing you know, you're the lead of the Thunderbirds. So weave us through just how your active duty career pieced together to get you to kind of where you are now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was ROTC like you were, and came out of University of Georgia and went to Vance Air Force Base in Enid, Oklahoma. And back during that time, you know, everybody flew T-37s, and then everybody flew T-38s, and somewhere in there, they would decide you had to be FAR qualified, and they would take like whatever percentage, and they would make that FAR qualified. And if you made that cut, you were able to choose what you wanted to go fly next. I think they do it a lot differently now, but and then it was a pretty brutal process. Everybody knew your rank order in the class, and that was publicized, well known, and they would put the airplanes up that were available. And you know, pilot number one in the class, what do you want? And he'd look at the list of all the classes and take whatever class he wanted, and or airplane. And then you know, on to number two. Number two, what do you want? Right. So through that process, I got very fortunate, and I flew the F-15. That's the plane I really wanted to fly. And from there, I flew in Kadena, and came back and did Holloman Air Force Base for a long time. Was the F-15 demo pilot for a while. Really enjoyed that. And then moved through the ranks like a lot of people, went back to the schoolhouse, taught there in the F-15 for a while, flew at Langley for a while, and then moved on to the Thunderbirds, you know, about the time I think I was an ops officer at Tyndall, and the release came out about, okay, it's time to hire a new round of Thunderbird pilots. One of them this year is the lead position. If you're an operations officer and you meet all these quals and you're interested, you know, put your package in. And so that's kind of, you know, in short where my career went. I did have that middle stint, you know, when you're on active duty, they want you to do the career broadening thing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, rightfully so, my boss was really trying to look out for my career. And he was pushing me to go to the Pentagon and take a staff tour. And I just really didn't want to do that. So I went and found my own little assignment, flying King Airs in the Philippines. And just had a ball doing that. My wife and I went, I was an assistant attache. We had three King Airs in the Philippines at the time. So my job was to sort of manage that fleet and be the chief sort of instructor of, you know, the O6s and the other people that would fly the King Air. And that was just an absolute ball. I can't say enough about the King Air and what a fantastic airplane that is.
You say stuff like that, and that makes me go, yeah. Because I've had friends who've done similar type jobs, right? And yeah. I always say, man, I learned about all these things the day after I make a decision and go for something else. It's like every
single time. Isn't that the case, man? Yeah.
Like, I remember when I went to Vance as well.
Okay.
And my favorite part about going to Vance is the decision I had in ROTC. So I had two decisions to make. I had a decision with whether I was going to stay at Marquette, Milwaukee, Wisconsin for an extended period of time and be a gold bar recruiter. And that was basically to be this ROTC brand new lieutenant who just commissioned and go out and recruit or to leave for pilot training. So that was decision one. And obviously I wanted to go and get my pilot training on. I wanted to get out there. 9/11 had just happened 4 months prior. I was, you know, chomping at the bit to get out there and fight and do and defend. Little did I know that what was going to happen was I was going to be stuck at Vance for 6 months waiting, or about 4 months to go to start pilot training anyways, which would have been about the same time that I would have stayed at home with all my college friends, living in my own apartment, not having to move, making my BAH and basically going into work once a week to get my recruiting materials and then drive around to different college job fairs and say, hey, do you want to go to ROTC and be a cadet? Not realizing how good of a deal that was, I was like, no, I want to get down to Vance in Oklahoma, Enid, Oklahoma, which isn't really quite Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So I made that one decision. But the other decision that came up was that good deal. The other good deal was I got offered either to go to Vance, which was the only Air Force pilot training base that I could go to, or I could go to Pensacola. And I was, those were my two options. And I chose, I want to go, I'm an Air Force pilot. I want to train with the Air Force all the way through. All my buddies are going to Vance. I'm glad I did. I met one of my best friends, God rest his soul, down there. We had a great time. However, there's a part of me that always goes, oh, T-34s on the beach?
On the beach, man, in Pensacola, that, or to go to Enid by the Sea, we used to call it, as you know. That's a tough one, man. Yeah. That's a tough one.
Yeah, so I...
But the Air Force is glad you did. We're thankful you did.
Yes, they are. Cheers, here to that. So I think that good deal and good decisions, I mean, you saw it before you were able to say, oh, before the decision was already made, you were able to make that decision to go do something like that. And then you go and you go do the Thunderbird thing, which I mean, we could just do a whole podcast on that, but we'll move on to the next piece there. After you're getting ready to retire, and it sounds like you made the active decision where you're going, you know what, I think my aviation career as a military pilot sufficed, and I'm not going to go and pursue the airline route, or I'm not going to pursue some form of aviation as a paying job anymore. How did that transpire?
That was a hard decision, and you're right. So the decision point came, stay in the Air Force, you know, and that career looked pretty good, but I was tired of going to the desert, and I knew that was in my future, and I had small children at the time, and people always told me, you'll know when the time's right and you're ready to retire. And it really was almost like overnight. I remember sitting at dinner looking at my wife going, I think I'm done. You know, I think I'm ready to move on to something else. And so we did. And at that time, the airlines were in a really turbulent period, and probably maybe 10 years leading up to that. So this was around 2004. And they had been in and out, you know, a bunch of consolidations and furloughs. And there was a glut of pilots at the time. And so I looked at the potential to go fly professionally. And I want to say like the first year pay or something for a first officer was something like $18,000 or something, you know? I mean, it was really bad. And meanwhile, I had some other offers to go in industry, which is, you know, a lot better than that. And I just couldn't see flying for that much, you know? I just couldn't see that kind of a salary to raise my family on and all that. Now, you know, it ramps up pretty quickly there. But that was a big factor in my decision. Is I just at the time I thought there's so much turmoil in the industry with these commercial jobs, and the pay wasn't that good. I'd be gone away from home a lot. So for me personally, I kind of made the decision through that lens. But now I look back at all my buddies that stayed with it and worked through all those rough times, you know, and they're captains now and they're making the big bucks and they're living the good life. And I'm like, good for you. And I'm really happy for them, you know, because they went through a lot. And now they're just doing great. Well, except for recently. Thankfully, a lot of them have the seniority to be able to ride out this wave that we're on.
Yeah. Well, that's the cycle of flying. And I think it goes far beyond just the commercial realm too. I think military has the same trials and tribulations. They're just different. It's a different version of what's happening in the commercial industry. And I think one of the things that makes it interesting is, so you go on to Hewlett Packard, so you go into industry, and now you're working, you give up the superhero cape, and now you're putting on the suit. And you did that prior to the AOPA, ASI stuff. And how does that, so I guess my question for this is, how does one just stops, quits cold turkey. I'm done with being a professional, combat aviator to becoming a industry man, business guy. And then one day it's like, you know what? I'm going back into aviation as my profession again, but a totally different twist on it.
Yeah. It was a little more nuanced than that, in that I was very fortunate. I started in GA, as I mentioned, I flew, my dad flew, and I started flying in about high school, college. probably college. So I flew in there and learned, you know, I'd really like to go fly for the military, and then did that. But all through that, I would come back home and fly with my dad. My brother's a big GA guy. He's a UPS captain now on 747s. But I was very fortunate in that even through the military, I kept my hand in GA and kept sort of working through that route. And then when I retired from the Air Force, yeah, it was a decision to give up flying for a living, but it wasn't giving up flying. I was still flying Bear Mountain.
Sure.
Somewhere in there, bought a Cherokee 140 because my son decided he wanted to fly. And so I bought that and taught him to fly in there. And then, somewhere in there, I got to where the job was initially with EDS, and then Hewlett-Packard bought EDS. And, you know, they treated me very well, and they paid me very well. But the work really wasn't that enjoyable. And I realized there was also going to be a limit to where I was going to go in that line of work. And the path, it wasn't really something I wanted to do. And I really missed aviation. So I began calling on AOPA. Probably took me about a couple years probably to find the right opening and what they thought was the right fit.
Yeah. And leads right into, so the Aviation Safety Institute. I have a tiny safety background. I don't even have an S identifier next to my name. For those of you Air Force guys, you know what that means. It means you're going to Afghanistan for a year. That's what it didn't mean. But
it also means you can get on the command.
It does. Yeah. That's a very true statement. And you can, especially in the Guard. My safety guys listening to this, you can get some, you can get a awesome deal as a safety, chief of wing safety, which in the Guard can be a phenomenal good deal for anybody. It's term limited, so you're not there forever, but man, those 3 to 4 years can be a great deal for you as far as flexibility and interest in actually interesting stuff going on in your job. So how did you get involved in the ASI? How did you go back from industry to, okay, I'm doing GA stuff, and then boom, I'm now, you know, this is the right fit. This is where I want to be.
Yeah. I had been talking to AOPA for a while about my desire to work for him. I obviously knew about him. I have a picture of my dad and I with AOPA jackets on back when, you know, I was in college. Okay. And he's got a blue one and I have a red one. So, you know, I knew about the organization and what it stood for and all that it did for pilots. And it was, to me, the premier GA organization, you know, was AOPA with the largest membership and the most clout. So I just really liked the organization and thought, you know, I would really like to go work there because GA gave a lot to me. It gave me the introduction to go fly for the military. You know, I got my start in GA. So the notion that you could get involved in helping sort of grow that and protect it, because it's so unique in this country, what we have in terms of the GA here, it's so unique. And I didn't realize how much it's under attack, quite frankly, until I came to work for AOPA. So that, you know, that was a real strong desire. Hey, this would be pretty cool to do something now, and you know, that's really meaningful. And so the conversations were back and forth about what is the right role, what's the right fit. And when the safety job opened up, then it was just, I think both of us recognized, hey, this is a great fit. And it is. I just love it. We wake up every day, got a small staff here, and our whole job is we want to make GA safer, right? And so every day we think to do that, you have to impact how people fly. To do that, you have to influence how they think. And to do that, you have to reach them with compelling, engaging content, right? Mm-hmm. So that's really what we're out to do.
And so one of the things I wanted to, and you led right into it. So we want to make GA safer, which then in turn makes every aspect of aviation safer, whether or not you're a GA participant or you're a professional only, or you do a mix of both, or however it looks to you. How does this then, your job, which projects mainly to the general aviation enthusiast and hobbyist and participant, how does that project then to the professional pilot who's in the military, who's in the and the commercial civilian structure side, or even now we have all these drone operators that are starting? And I mean, that, you know, people like to knock them, they're not real pilots, but some of them are real pilots, quote unquote, on the side, and they're also doing drone operation for work or for, or just for fun. Cause it is fun to show your kids how, hey, look what I can do with all this, this crazy gadgetry. So how does that, how does that project out to all these other areas?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. You know, we try to start in general aviation with this sort of culture of safety. But, you know, there is a distinction. Like I came from the military, and people that came from the military or come from the airlines can appreciate this. Formal structured flying, when you're doing it for a living, does a fairly good job of squeezing just about all the fun out of the flying. Because it's proceduralized, there's so much documentation involved. So many of the decisions are taken out of your hands because the book says you have to do this under these circumstances. And so that's all fine and great, and it's why commercial aviation is so safe. And sometimes people will come from that environment and they'll say, well, what we need to do is make GA more like that. And it's just a caution to them that, well, not exactly, because GA is about recreation and about private travel, and that's a slightly different lens. And probably the biggest difference is when you're, when you own your own airplane and you're a GA pilot, you're the chief of maintenance, you're the chief of operations, you're the chief dispatcher, the chief finance, right? Every one of those decisions is up to you. The winds, are they favorable for you today? How are you up to flying today? Is your airplane up to flying today? I used to joke the F-15, you know, if it wasn't leaking hydraulic fluid, that means it didn't have any in it, right? So you would have a hydraulic leak, and the maintenance guys, you'd be down at EOR, and they would literally be counting the number of drops per minute, right? And if it was less than some threshold, then okay, it's not leaking too bad, you can go, right? Well, that drops per minute now is you as the pilot of a GA airplane, right? You're like, well, what do you think? Is it going to hold up for flight or not? So the point of that is it really is a different lens. But when we're successful, we cherry pick the stuff that can be pulled into the GA environment and used for GA pilots to help make them safer. So we look really carefully at the military and the airlines. We get a lot of good feedback from both that help us with, you know, how do we do that? What's the right mix of that?
Mm-hmm. I think that's that cannot be pronounced out and projected to the flying group that TPN is enough, is that it takes all kinds, right? You got, if you don't have it, you're going to get very pigeonholed on your thought processes. I think guard units, reserve units, active duty units on the Air Force side really have this issue at times, is they start to homogenize too much. And the next thing you know is you're running down this path of, well, this is the way, and they may not even say this, but this is the way we've always done it, without realizing that there's 10 far better, more efficient, more effective ways to be, whether it's safety or other process out there related. And there's ways to clean that up really rapidly. And the best way is communication. And the way to communicate is through exactly what you just said, keeping people congealing together, for lack of a better term, to talk about this stuff. I think that leads me into the next question I really had about this was, so you see this in a much different light than I ever will, while I'm currently employed at the places I am. What's your perspectives on the current safety trends that you're seeing out there, good, bad, some initiatives and these critical areas that are going to pave the way forward for us, not only in GA, but just in aviation in general? We were talking before we even started the podcast about the automation and AI structure that we see coming down the road, and how that's going to change this whole ball of wax for all of us. So that's kind of my next question concern.
Yeah, you it's a great question too. In context, the fatal accident rate in general aviation is about 0.95 per 100,000 flight hours. So if you put that in context, statistically, the average GA pilot flies about 50 hours a year. So if you were to take a statistically average pilot, and we know no such thing exists, but you know, for context, that means they would have to fly for about 2,000 years before statistically they got caught up in a fatal accident. Now, cutting that in half, when you take like the personal flying rate, because it's more than that, right, than all of GA, the personal flying rate, it's about half, about double. So cut that in half. You're still talking about flying for about 1,000 years on average statistically, before, you know, you got caught in a fatal accident. So why do I mention that? Every fatal accident we have in aviation, and now you and I are talking general aviation, makes the news. Every one of them does. And so the challenge is that's what the general public thinks of general aviation and small airplanes. They think, oh my God, this is dangerous. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've heard that. You probably heard the same thing. Your neighborhood, you know, kid wants to go flying with you. And the first reaction out of the parents is, oh my God, that seems so dangerous. And it's really not. And it's well within our ability to make it even safer than it is. And now our fatal accident rate is about half of what it was in the mid 90s. We in aviation always have done and continue to do a really good job of lessons learned and applying those lessons learned so they truly are not lessons observed, but really lessons learned and getting better. So to kind of to get to your other question, like what, you know, where do we go from here? What, how do we keep getting better? We like to think of it as like this five principled model here in the Air Safety Institute. And we kind of think of it this way. If you take knowledgeable people and you train them well and keep them proficient, put them in reliable equipment and surround them with a culture that helps good decision making, you'll run safe operations. And so it's all about that knowledge, training, proficiency, equipment, and culture. And if you want to improve in safety, you got to hit all five of those. You can't cherry pick one of those. If you really want to move the needle, you're constantly working all five of those things. And so you made a really good observation about technology in the cockpit and what that means. For the most part, it's been very, very beneficial to us. You know, all the things that even GA pilots can get in their cockpit now to help their SA with moving maps and in cockpit weather and even noise reduction headsets, angle of attack indicators, this kind of stuff wasn't available, very easily, even 15 years ago. So we're making tremendous strides with that equipment, but it's up to us as an industry to figure out how do we train pilots on it to when to use it properly. Because just like anything in a cockpit, it can be really effective for you unless you use it at the wrong time. Then it can actually be very, problematic for you. Yep. And so, you know, that in therein kind of lies the challenge that we're working.
It's very reminiscent of the same conversations that I've had with safety experts or investigator types in the Air Force. And some of my friends on the civilian side, when they do investigation stuff for in company or whatever, same exact thing. And it's this, the interface of humans and technology, and figuring out how that interface best plays out is truly is the biggest safety issue going forward for the foreseeable future. Amazing. And it doesn't matter what phase of flight. That's the thing that I'm most troubled, but also just amazed by, is whether you're taxiing on the ground, all the way to cruise or critical phase of approach and landing, it doesn't matter anymore. There's so many choke points because of the technology boom that's happening within your airplane. And for those of us who transition between two or three different airplanes for the military and then for the civilian side, that can be, we always talk about negative transfer. And I think negative transfer is a really bad thing when you have two airplanes that are similarly close together. When you have two airplanes that are very far apart, like my Airbus and my KC-135, sometimes it's pretty easy to keep the two separated. But it's, to me, it's the environments in which I'm operating. Yeah. If I'm always operating within Milwaukee, and this goes for a GA pilot, in my opinion, if you're always operating and you're just doing laps around Oshkosh, you're going to get really, really good at that. But you're going to get complacent, because that's going to make you think that you're better than you are once you get out into a more rich dynamic environment. Same with me. I fly predominantly, do pattern work at Milwaukee and stuff that's right around the area for my missions for KC-135 refueling. If I don't go out and do more, I get complacent thinking, hey, I'm good again because I know how to do everything. That's not true. So I think we need to keep that expansion going and tie that in with all the different technologies that are happening outside of the cockpit as well as inside the cockpit, CPDLC, ADS-B, all that kind of stuff that's online now or coming online for some of us. So I think a great way to do that is to then reach out past your comfort point for you guys and gals in the military and the folks out there who are civilian commercial pilots who aren't really doing much more than that. And go check out some of the stuff that the AOPA and other groups have that are resources available to you. So Richard, can you just kind of share with us some of the great resources that AOP's got? I've looked at them on the website. There's a lot. There's too much to go and research all in one day or even a week. So what's all out there for us?
Yeah, we have a ton of content at AOPA, and we're really proud of it. So AOPA, as I mentioned, is the largest advocacy group for general aviation in the world, really. It's the dominant one here in the U.S., and that really is at the core of what we did when we started some 80 years ago. And it was five pilots that sat around, and they realized, hey, you know, the military is getting stronger, and the commercial airlines are starting to boom. If we don't sort of stand up for ourselves and start protecting this for general aviation, it's going to go away. And I'm so thankful for those five people and their foresight, because the U.S. is unlike really any place in the world in terms of your access in general aviation. So, you know, that's really what we're about. And from the very start, safety was an important principle. So they wanted to protect the access to it, make it affordable, and keep it safe. And that's still really the core driving principles of what we do at AOPA. So there's a membership part of what we do. And if you appreciate aviation in this country, I encourage you to look at us and think about becoming a member and supporting general aviation. On the aviation safety side, our board of directors and our membership have been pretty, clear with us that the rising tide lifts all boats in terms of safety. So almost all of our safety material is free to anyone, airsafetyinstitute.org. And this year, our material will be accessed over 12 million times. So,
wow.
We worked hard at making good, compelling content that just helps make better and safer pilots. So we've got videos, we have our separate YouTube channel, we have a podcast called There I Was, where we invite pilots on to tell us their stories, and that's a lot of fun. That'll be downloaded over a million times this year. We release an episode a month. So, you're right, it's a lot of content. You're not going to surf it in an hour or two, right? But come check us out, and however you like to consume it. I mean, that's kind of what I sort of brought that with me from the IT industry is, however you consume information, we want to be there with safety information. It's all accessible through mobile devices. It's always on. It's always there. So check us out.
That's fantastic. We'll set up a link for everybody to go look at the ASI and beyond in the show notes. And it's also something that I probably need to go look a little bit even more into, because I keep having this bug in the back of my head that's telling me, hey, we've got one little girl, one on the way, and we want to start doing a little bit more family travel, but not travel like we were always planning on, AKA, we're going to go to Paris for a week because dad's no longer doing the international flying, but more like, hey, what if we had an airplane and we were able to take it up to northern Wisconsin and spend a couple of days camping out underneath the wing and the stars and all that good stuff, or going down that road a little bit. And my daughter, who is always loves looking up, she's like her dad as a kid, loves looking up and seeing the airplanes, has asked why there's not as many in the sky anymore. And I figure I now owe it to her to show her that you can still fly airplanes, maybe not professionally, but you can be an orthodontist and then own as many airplanes as you want because you've got more money than any pilot or whatever the case is. But I want her to have that experience. And I think for those of you out there who are just like me, who miss the flying aspect of our job, because some of us haven't been flying as much as we care to, there are other ways to get involved. Maybe not immediately because of finances or capabilities, but a great way that I have noticed and started by just researching on the AOPA website to go down that road is something to just really kind of start to wrap your head around. And the other thing is like Richard was saying, free safety information that spans all sorts of different stuff that we're not used to being exposed to as professional aviators is just marvelous. And and I hope we can contribute something back. How would you ask our folks to be able to contribute back to AOPA besides getting a membership or any of that? What can they do to help with the safety aspect of it for real?
Yeah. There's a couple different ways. Thanks for asking that. Certainly go on and take a look at our material and send us feedback. I mean, we, you know, are relatively small staff. We don't have all the answers. So we love getting feedback of, hey, you know, you could think about this next time you do this, or I would have added that, or I think this is incorrect. We pay attention to all that to help make it better. So that's really good. You know, of course you can consider a donation to the foundation. Thank you. And that would be helpful. So we'll take those as well. But yeah, and I just want to add to what you mentioned, Adam. And one thing about the pandemic is general aviation has actually been thriving in the pandemic. Our activity levels in a lot of our sectors are up because people are thinking, well, you know, I can't fly the airlines, or it's become more difficult, or whatever the challenge is, hotels and all that. But what I can do is get in an airplane or an airplane with some friends, abide by all the, you know, social distancing norms, and go camp out, go stay in a cabin. And it's really, it's really a phenomenal way to travel in this day and time. And if you kind of come back to those roots, a lot of your audience is professional, you'll just have a ball with it. I mean, it's a ton of fun, and they're still aviation people. Mm-hmm. So all the people you normally meet, you know, they still love to talk flying. They love to talk airplanes, great storytellers by and large, you know, it's a great community we
awesome.
Have.
That is a true statement. It kind of expands far beyond the scope of whether you wear a flight suit or epaulets. We all kind of come from the same. We all started at the same place. We all looked up and got put a little smile on our face and said, "You know what? I think I might want to try that." And then, lo and behold, here we are. So this is the time of the podcast that we call the memory items. Us Air Force guys would call it boldface. So I got three bold face questions, as we like to ask, and we'll just go right down the list, and you shoot off what you think. So number one, the one thing that the TPN podcast listenership should take away about the safety ideas of AOPA and ASI.
I get asked that a lot, and what I tell people is go fly. If you want to be a safer pilot, invest your money. If you have a limited amount of money, invest it in ABGAS, meaning whatever you're flying, be as proficient as possible in that platform. So go fly. It always makes you a better pilot.
That is an awesome, I think I'm going to blow that up and put it right in front of me so I go see it next week. Go fly. All right. Number two, something that you would have told young Richard, just starting out on his journey through all of this. So this is kind of professional, personal, whatever, that he absolutely must do.
I might tell him to, hey, just look around a little more and kind of smell the roses as you go. This is a pretty good journey you're on, and things are going to be okay. You know, don't worry so much about the future. Kind of enjoy the day a little more. Yeah.
Well, that seems to be the standard alpha pilot type really? Response. Yeah. Because I think most of us are, we always going, okay, we do this episode called the Touch and Go, and the Touch and Go is a very short blurb that I did. I did one called What's Next, and it's the pilot's number one question. Everything they do is what's next.
Right.
So Especially military, but all pilots. So you graduate pilot training. What's next? Okay, it's B course or RTU or whatever. And then you graduate. Okay, you're wingman or you're co-pilot. What's next? Aircraft commander, instructor, upgrade, 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 upgrade. And then finally, one day, there is no more what's next. And then normally, you're only about 40 some odd years old when the what's next stops. And now you go, oh no, what's next? Like the real what's next? Do I continue to fly? Do I, like you went through? What's my next professional choice? And you realize that the what's next needs to stop. And every now and again, you just go, wait a second, what's going on right now? Look at this, man. I'm flying an F-16 or I'm stuck in Paris for 3 days because I was on a 777 flight where the engine went. And now I'm stuck here. Enjoy yourself, you know, like take a moment.
You know what helps with that, Adam, if we have a little more time, I don't mean to get too lengthy on the answers, but I just recently bought a 1993 Super Cub, It's a Piper PA-18. Okay. I bought it in New Mexico. A Super Cub's a 150 horsepower airplane. It seats two. I flew it back from New Mexico, and I thought, well, while I'm out there, I'm just going to bounce around the backcountry a little bit and fly in Idaho and these really remote strips. The whole time I'm doing that, and I'm making my way back east to Frederick, I'm flying at about 500 or 1,000 feet. It goes about 100 miles an hour. I got satellite, you know, music pumped into my headset. And it was such an enjoyable experience that I found myself thinking more than once, why did it take me so long to realize how enjoyable this is? Just the pure essence of flying and nobody around you to talk, you know, you can talk to people if you want, or you can not talk to people. And it's kind of that, man, why did it take me so long to realize how much fun this is?
I had a similar, not as cool of an experience, where I've had one flight in a Cub with a buddy of mine, and he took my wife up first and then I went up, and when we landed, it was only 20-30 minutes and we landed, and I said, I can't believe I forgot how much fun not only flying was, but how awesome just life in general from that viewpoint turns out to be. And one of the big things I tell my wife and my mom specifically, whenever the weather's kind of crappy, my mom goes, oh, you guys went and flew today. And I said, yeah, we did. And they said, Mom, you know, the best part about that is I got to see the sun and nobody else did here. And I said, and when you come out of that last cloud deck and boom, there it pops out and it's beautiful blue sky and sun. I said, it's really, you forget that you're actually working for a minute or two and you enjoy it again. So.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah, it's just a great experience. And there are so many times where it was tough to remember there was a pandemic going on. You know, you're looking across this beautiful country of ours, and we're really in some difficult times here now. But you're right, you forget about all that.
So go fly, people. Go fly. We'll go back to number one. Go fly. All right.
Come to Frederick. I'll take you up in my Super.
There you go. Perfect. Awesome. I'm down. Number three. Someone who wants to get involved, and we kind of talked about this a little bit, wants to get involved in the safety aspects of aviation, what they must do. It doesn't have to be AOPA, but since you are a safety guru, what can they do besides go fly, kind of get more into the weeds and nuts and bolts of the program?
Yeah, I would say, keep gaining experience, because that experience becomes valuable. And then gain as much sort of investigative experience or lessons learned kind of experience that you can gain. Because what I've found is in general aviation, there'll be an accident. And if it's a fatal accident, on average, it'll take the NTSB 2 years to figure out the cause of the accident. Well, by that time, the cause of the accident may have changed because new technology came out, or, I mean, you know, who knows? So somewhere in there, we'll try to glean some of the lessons learned that came out of that a little bit sooner. And an awful lot of that goes from your instinct as a pilot. Looking at this scenario, this kind of looks like this. It feels like this that I've read before or seen before or analyzed before. So you go back and start looking through that stuff. All of that background is really helpful.
Well, folks, that kind of wraps up a lot of what Richard and I were planning on talking about. But before Rich goes, I want to give him any other chance, anything else he'd like to say. And then where can they reach you to, Richard, if people want to reach out to you on the SI?
Yeah, sure. AirSafetyInstitute.org is our website. Or you can find me at richard.mcspadden@aopa.org. And if that's, you know, too long to remember, just go on the website and you'll find my email there. And I'm happy to chat with you. Would love the feedback on any of our material, especially. There's a lot of people on here that have a whole lot of experience. So we'd love to get your experience and what we can leverage better for GA pilots and, you know, how you can improve the stuff we're offering. We'd love to hear.
So TPN, listen up. You get to actually change for the better, make some changes. This isn't the Air Force. We can actually make something happen. It doesn't move slow. It doesn't have to move slow. Remember, the federal government's not in charge of this. This is an organization. I kid. Or do I?
Adam, I love what you guys are doing. Thanks so much for including us as a part of it. But really, just thanks for what you're doing and piecing the community together and the message that you have. And really good stuff.
Well, we're humbled that we get praise like that. And we would love to incorporate every single member of the AOPA to come and participate, whether, I mean, because they have stories to share with our professional type aviators who would love to hear it, because we've got that nice mix. There's people who do both in the pilot network, and we'd love to see more us professionals get involved with the GA side. And we'd love for more of the young GA folks who have the opportunity going forward to be involved in the professional side of aviation too, because we need the best, we need the brightest if we're going to keep the community strong. And the best and brightest are normally some of the most experienced that are out there. So thank you for what you do, Richard. Thanks to your staff. Tell everybody there. Again, thanks. And we got this, folks, I want to tell you, we got this podcast in, I think, the email went out on like a Tuesday, and here we are on a Friday, scheduled to do this. Yeah, get it done.
Let's get it done.
I like that mindset. So again, thanks to the AOPA, the Air Safety Institute, Richard McSpadden, for joining us. If you want to reach him, go to ASI.org. You can go there or hit him up at richard.mcspadden@aopa.org, or just go to the website and you can fish around there. If you need to reach us, you can hit us up at heyguys@thepilotnetwork.com. That's right, we're a .com now. We're moving away from the .org, and we want to get your suggestions, comments, concerns, complaints, critiques, or just overall good vibes, whatever's going on in your life. And please check out the community.thepilotnetwork.com website and join us. For those of you who don't know, that's our premium paid membership site. We're going to be adding way more features, discounts, free stuff, all sorts of cool things that the Facebook group falls shy on. So if you are flying out there all around the world, remember, keep the shiny side up and the greasy side down. We will talk to you later. Thanks for joining us. Thanks again, Richard.